This afternoon, we are taking up the second half of this day's theological reflection, dealing with the challenge of fundamentalism as it applies to the pressing issues of the church and society. The first presenter for our afternoon's program is Pastor Kenneth Gelming, who was educated at the University of Nebraska and at Dallas Seminary, an institution of which we heard a few things this morning. He is chairman of the Department of Theology at Baptist Bible College in Springfield, Missouri, where he has taught for 22 years, as your program indicates. It also indicates there that he is a parish pastor, Cherry Street Baptist Church in Springfield, and he is, moreover, and perhaps this is his matter about which he will be speaking at some length, he is the state chairman of the Moral Majority in Missouri. So without any more information, I will allow Dr. Gelming to make his presentation. Sir?
Being from Dallas Theological Seminary, and also as chairman of the Missouri Moral Majority, and then a Baptist, maybe I should run right now. I have earnestly appreciated the men who spoke this morning and appreciate the invitation. I've always felt that even though one did not agree on all points, we should agree to disagree honorably. And I feel in my own heart I appreciate the Lutheran Church, especially the Missouri Synod. I have not been a stranger to it. And so I want to thank you for the opportunity of being here. I have a bit of a problem with such a subject that seems in my studying here and preparing to be quite broad, perhaps would do better with a little more singularity, but I'm going to do the best that I can on it. I believe regarding society, first of all, and the problems of our world, it may be like my little grandson expressed. I think it may be a very complicated situation which we will have troubles solving. My little grandson, whose name is Kenny, during the winter wanted to have our white kitty come into the house. Mrs. Gelming does not like that, but she agreed to, being that he was the grandson. The problem with white kitty was she was going to have little kitties. And of all the crazy things in the world, the snow was blowing outside. I looked over there in the family room, and would you believe, under the chair, here came two little kitties out from under it, just barely born. And I said to my wife, I said, "Dear, she's having kittens." She said, "Oh, no." With that, little Kenny came over, and he looked at those two little bitty kitties, and he said, "Papa, Papa, how does she make those?" That was very baffling to him. And I think many of our problems are very difficult. Maybe, though, it is there also, we overreact to them. Last week, I was down in Arkansas with a gentleman, and he had an 11-year-old son. He thought he would have a little time off with his son, thought that he would ask him if there were any problems that he had with his home. And he was, of course, looking at psychological problems. What are you going to do with your dad and your mother? And he said, "Son," in the boat, they were traveling there, he says, "is there anything that's bothering you?" 11-year-old son said, "Yes, sir, yes, Dad." He was very quiet, and he thought, "Oh, my, I'm going to have a son that's maladjusted here. What in the world's it going to be?" And he held his breath what the son was going to say, and he said, "Oh," he says, "those decimals in school are just killing me." Maybe we overreact. Now, I want to deal, first of all, with something that I believe is necessary in this discussion, and would like to deal with the term in my assignment, fundamentalism, first of all. Now, there needs to be some definitions in this field, and in general definitions, we would find Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary says fundamentalism is a movement in 20th century Protestantism emphasizing the literally interpreted Bible as fundamental to Christian life and teaching. Well, that is very general. It also is recorded, it is the term that denotes a movement in theology. In recent decades, designed to conserve the principles which are at the foundation of the Christian system and to resist what were considered dangerous theological tendencies in the movement calling itself modernism. Its tenets are not those of any distinctive Protestant denomination, but comprise the verities essential to the Christian gospel as inherited from all branches of the Reformation. And then Carl Henry says of it in a general definition that in America, John Gerstner states five fundamentals were first defined at the Presbyterian General Assembly in 1910. Also, in the last 40 years, conservatives and major denominations are not often called fundamentalists, partly because their denominations are not identified with National Association of Evangelicals and so forth, which is from Carl Henry. But leaving those general definitions, I have attempted here to bring this definition down in perhaps four, which I believe to be somewhat stereotyped, groups of them. Now, really, when we say fundamentalism, it is almost as diverse as a snowflake. The snowflake is comprised of snow, but almost every snowflake is diverse from the other. And so I have put to a term on this, and I think that you would identify somewhat with it. The first one of these types of fundamentalists I have termed the fighting fundamentalists. Now, that group of fundamentalist people, these essentially hold what we would call, I believe, the basic tenets of faith of the gospel. The fighting fundamentalists are those which are exceptionally militant. And traditionally, very emotional. They have a past and a present, perhaps being uneducated. And with that, dogmatism. Now, there is usually in this type of fundamentalism some vibrant, uncontested leader who is pretty well a spokesman for the group. And in those, often, there are other definite separation standards, and the group is probably characterized, and I think rightly so, by not very much love. There is, secondly, and this is a Gilmingism, a flabby fundamentalist, not thinking of his body build. He is not at all militant. And he is especially appalled at dogmatism of the fighting fundamentalist. He is especially appalled at the uneducated dogmatism and probably swings now almost to the other side of this pendulum. He may be more educated, he may not be, but particularly in the dogmatism, he has another viewpoint of almost an antinomialist idea, both in separation and other positions, while he himself would claim fundamental doctrines. To him, it is fundamentalism is an individualism. It is often a stool of an informed or uninformed discussion, low-key, almost at the opposite pole of the fighting fundamentalist. And in this group, I would place and while we do not put all in a group, these are only basic, general thoughts on this, charismatics, perhaps Pentecostal groups, and other of groups in this nature and others that that are such. Then there are those which are the factual fundamentalists, which accept, again, basic doctrines, basic parts of the Christian faith, which places them inside enough to be, in most people's thinking at least, by definition, a fundamentalist. Now, they have lost in their they've lost in their thinking a lot of importance as far as the system is concerned. They're not really as concerned about being called a fundamentalist or not being called a fundamentalist. Perhaps would rather not be called a fundamentalist, yet essentially hold those doctrines. The group does not essentially like to get into much of a social conflict. They are pacifistic and often ingrown in their own places, and they feel that oftentimes they can or cannot get involved in the social issues of government, in this particular the socialistic programs. Then the last is, again, my terminology of a biblicentric fundamentalist, which I would term to say is one who is educated in proper education. He accepts education and holds historical, traditional views that have been extant since the cross, and attempts at least in an honest way to hermeneutically put all Scripture into a setting and apply that Scripture in all of his areas of life, all areas of life. In the agape basis of life, he himself is concerned with his neighbor. He himself is concerned with his family and tries to express his life theologically and historically. What would Jesus do? Exalting the Scripture, and in essence would not have much kinship with what we would know as humanism or secularism, in that, in a common understanding, and rightly so, he would feel he had a balanced life. Now, in those four groups, they do pertain to politics. And again, if I may now make one bridge across into politics. I think it's as good right now for me to explain to you maybe my part in the politics of this as a pastor and also as an administrator in a college. I became quite concerned with government control of institutions and churches from my own personal point of view. And this was some years ago. And seemingly the very best one could do, these just kept with a strangling hold, kept coming on institutions and schools and churches. And so having concern with this, I just happened to be, I came to this problem of what are we going to do for the freedoms that we do not erode, have our freedoms eroded, such as you have of a seminary here or your churches. We can preserve those freedoms and we can stay as we are through the years. What can we do? And into this situation, I happened to attend a meeting, and I was interested in it only. It was a meeting of a moral majority, and of all things, I was at the right place at the wrong time. And I was elected then as 2 years ago in April of this year, the chairman of the moral majority of Missouri. And so it has been somewhat, all of this, an education in a sense, but I would like to leave this with you this afternoon of some of the right understanding of the moral majority, for there is such confusion with it from the normal point of view. But now, as these different groups of fundamentalism react to politics, and if you'll bridge with me here now for a moment, the fighting fundamentalists are almost always like loose cannons going off. You never know where one's going to go kerblooey and say something that's intensely embarrassing to everybody, which the press picks up, and there, from that point on, there is no retrieve. And these people make it their own business. You can feel quite happy in having a synod that can speak in one direction and that you would not be embarrassed in this way, because you can have a unified front. Now, the second group, then, the flabby fundamentalists, have very little organization toward politics. And while the man would vote in a fairly, I suppose you'd say, fundamental nature, and I do not know you, you don't know me in essence, but when I say that, probably he is anti-abortion and anti-pornography. He probably votes basically in what he would call the basic tenets of separation in fundamentalism. But he simply goes to the ballot box, and whatever he finds there when he opens it up, may not know the guy who he's voting for at all. And if he does, that he would vote that way. The third, the factual fundamentalists are divided among themselves. And this group would probably work more indirectly, particularly in politics. In the area, I find in my being now in this a couple of years, they are not anti-politics at all, but they work in different ways. One of these is in the area of lobbying. And I want to say a few things about that in a moment. The other group now, and the name that has been associated with this is, of course, Dr. Jerry Falwell. And there's another group that finds itself suddenly in a limelight and it's called The New Right, other things too. And I'd like to lay out essentially the thinking of the license that they would find to be in this part of our country's makeup. But first of all, before I do, it seems that the moral majority has taken a great deal of criticism for its part in politics. And Jerry Falwell himself has been, in fact, just a couple or three days ago, he was in to see Reagan, and he has had a very important input into politics. Now, groups, whether we like it or not, the very fact that they are elected officers do have a great deal of emphasis in government on politics in our life. A president, whether he is Baptist or Catholic or Lutheran, by his appointments, though he may not in any way be addressed to lobbying, he throws great impetus in the government toward his religious organization. And I don't think anyone is too naive to understand that. Now, but as far as the indirect method, for years there have been groups in lobbying who have far outstripped the present New Right. The Catholics, the United States Catholic Confederation, as it was originally called, the National Catholic Welfare Conference, dates back to 1919. And its lobbying division alone in D.C. last year was $285,000. It promoted with five professionals in these fields of liberal policies, of social welfare, foreign policy, immigration, and civil rights, which they were pro. And negatively, they were against abortion and one other thing, I forget what it was at the moment here. The Southern Baptists represent nine Baptist bodies in Washington, D.C., with an annual budget of $329,000. And the United Methodists have been in the business since 1920. They have a $1 million lobbying budget this year. And then as even with Baptists, I understand there are a number of Lutherans, as there are Baptists, but the Lutheran Council in the USA has maintained its Office of Governmental Affairs, the OGA, since 1946. It represents the Lutheran Church of America, the American Lutheran Church, and the Associated Evangelical Lutheran Churches. And according to the material which I got, the Lutheran Missouri Synod cooperates with the Lutheran Council, but does not participate in any social action or political ministry, Charles Bergstrom, the OGA director, said. But its budget is $200,000 a year. Now, the Presbyterians, $110,000. The National Council of Churches has been there since 1966, very highly visible, and with literally almost a budget that is practically unlimited. And they're purporting racial justice, arms control, these are the areas they work, disarmament, capital punishment, education, food and agricultural, housing and health, immigration, pro-Arab, anti-Israel, are basically the areas they lobby. Now, same with the Jews. Have one, as well as the National Association of Evangelicals, Seventh-day Adventists, and it's interesting that, as far as I can find, there are no Mormon lobby groups. However, they work in a different channel and way. And what I'm saying, I think, this afternoon is this, that whether we admit it or not, nearly every religious group has some government participation. Now, the New Right has come into some tremendous criticism for its part in that. And so essentially, in my opinion, what has happened now in the last few years is that the liberal element of our country has almost been let to go its own way. And conservative, evangelical, orthodox people have pretty well been just minding their business, doing their chores, till suddenly they found that there was an encroachment upon their freedoms, upon the things that they hold dear. And so consequently, they then got into the act in a highly visible way, which in the last election made a very important impact in the change of the country. Whether you agree with it or whether you don't, there was a great change in this. Now, so there are, first of all, groups have been and will be. We just need not be naive. They are in government. And then we would ask, secondly, though, does our Constitution allow such a thing? And essentially, we would have to say, in my opinion, in examining the Constitution closely, there were two things the men who wrote it were concerned about in the area we're talking about. I have no quarrel. I don't know about whether the men were mentioning or they were deists, etc., and so on, but they did harvest from England certain documents which laid basic rights, which were based essentially upon the Scriptures. And those were framed into the Constitution, regardless of whether they were this or not, or whatever they were. Now, in that Constitution, it made provision that there would be no state church. This is not the ordinary interpretation of the judges. That coming from England, where there was a state church, where she would impose her views and so on the assembly, on the people, and that secondly, there would be no interference from the state in practice of free religion. Now, that would mean essentially this, brought down to the bottom line, because you are a Christian, will not negate you from being a citizen. You are as much a citizen as anyone else. And you have the rights and the privileges as Paul had in defending himself because you're a citizen of the United States, but you also have the provision that the government does not come into the area of the church. There is a freedom there that is protected. Now, this gives variance. And we believe that even with Madeleine Murray O'Hare, as much as we would disagree with her, we would fight for her right. We would fight for her right to be what she is. But I would like my right to be what I am, to function inside the government rules and the government privileges as well. Now, that kind of constitution has protected the hucksters as well as, and there are, they're everywhere. It has protected the atheists. It's protected the humanists. They are classed as a religion. They have a tax write-off, a tax exemption, just as you have. They are classed as a religious body. And we have somehow, you know, you get these phrases parroted around, the separation of church and state. Now, our Constitution does not say there should be a separation of church and state. The Soviet Constitution says that exactly. Not ours. Ours here has given to us the privilege of a separation of the government upon us and coming up into our problems. Now we have a republic form of government, a representative form of government. Now, folks, I was asked as well, would I bring in the social aspects of this? I feel that I would be incorrect, that I'd be wrong, if I did not participate in the opportunities that God has provided me in living within this country to put myself into my local situation, which deals with government. Now, we say we are opposed to take whatever thing that you want, whatever thing that you feel is wrong. You can get out on a corner and holler about it for 100 years, and it won't do a whit of good. But inside the framework that God has provided, and God sets up government according to the Bible, you have every opportunity to go to that legislature or that congressman and to say to him, "Sir, I am an adherent in your district, and I am concerned about this. You have a right to organize others as well." And he says, "I'm not for that. You have a right the next time the vote comes up to vote for someone or to have someone run for that office who will profitably put a man in that office that will give our country direction and sanity." I am not a pessimist by nature. My wife says, "World could fall in on your head and you'd find something good to say." I am not a pessimist. I believe that we should do what we can at the moment, at the opening of a gate. If God, in His sovereignty, has opened up these things to us, we should use them and do what we can at the moment. Can we turn it around? Who knows? But I would not say that I would let little Kenny grow up and he would say to me someday, "Papa, why didn't you do something about this when you could?" I will not be found in that category. Now, this is the place where the action is. We take a great deal of criticism and even threats on our lives sometimes for simply getting into this. When Moral Majority came out so strong against pornography, we had 5 basic organizations, but you'd probably be called mafia groups, who really get nasty. Now, if you want action, that's where the action is. You touch a vital chord here, men. And believe me, it is a place where God has permitted change. We talk about, I think, fundamentalists, and I must include myself. I have been very, very lax on this. I taught for years in my college, do not get involved in politics. I stood in front of my classes and I lectured with real principle. And then the more that I became involved in this, I recognized, well, what principles do we have? And we ought to deal in principles, not in emotion. What can we substantiate here? And I realize that the problem of church and state, or religion and state, has been a problem almost from the beginning of time as far as the religious record is concerned with our Bible. And in the Old Testament, you'll record that when you dealt with the prophet and you dealt with the king, in the prophet, I realize it was a theocracy, but it was the prophet who gave the direction to the king. It was not the king who gave the direction to the prophet. Now, we need leadership. If anyone's going to help this world and to give it some stability and tell it and show where it's going and give direction, you young men must do that. This will not be found in other places. I don't believe you will find it in higher education, It must be laid upon the shoulders of us as professors and you as young men who hold the foundations of life. It was not the king. It was the government, you remember, partly, that gave such trouble to the Lord Jesus Christ. And so it has been. Now, fundamentalism today has been grossly distorted in these areas by the press. Partially, the press is liberal itself. That press is very difficult to get a good story from. I have had TV stations interview me, and I would say such things, and when it came out, it was deliberately cut and edited to say exactly opposite of what I said. What can you do? You can't do anything about it. And then, as well, just rather recent, when the moral majority moved into the matter of pornography, Norman Lear and others, the porn books and so forth, dumped massive amounts of money into smear, bought television time, and you're not even aware unless you know these programs. They're highly propagandized, and they sweep our nation in three networks. The loose cannons that go off as well give you bad names. Now, what is happening today in this, it is polarizing. Those that are for or pro are becoming very pro. Those that are anti are becoming very anti. It is polarizing. In my opinion, the future of it, I don't know. I don't think that either of these factions are going to go away. There are people who are dedicated nearly to the giving of blood on both sides. I don't think it's going to go away. It becomes a part of their life, part of their heritage. They are Christocentric, and the vehicle here would be politics. Now, I'm just about to the end of my time and have a couple of other things, but I would also call to your attention that there are a host of groups in the New Right. May I list them? Christian Voice, Budget 3 Million, 37,000 clergy. Then there is the Moral Majority. The National Christian Action Coalition, Catholics for Christian Political Action, Religious Roundtable, Library Court, the intelligentsia of it, Christian Embassy, American Conservative Union, Conservative Caucus, American Legislative Exchange Council, Committee for Survival of a Free Congress, American Enterprise Institute, and on they go. A lot of these get cataloged into and onto Moral Majority. We do not. Take a candidate and say, here's our candidate. Well, in the other part of this, and just with a few minutes, what about the social work and the social needs? The government man has cut into one of the vital places in every one of our denominations. You read the Old Testament and the New, and how much space and teaching is given to the poor, to the widows, and that group of people. You'll find it's immense. I did not realize this until I began to check it out. Now, this has been a place where the ministry has been very effective. You help a person with his soul or his body, I mean, and you'll touch his soul, and you will make that man a believer. It's a tremendous opportunity of service. The government has taken this over. What do we do about it? I don't know. For instance, a boys' home, a very fine boys' home. It costs $4,000 to keep one boy for a year in this particular boys' home. In the same town, the government cost is over $1 million per child. The Christian boys' home has very few returnees back the second time. The government percentage is horrendously high. 4,000 over a million plus. I am saying this, I think, that if our churches could, instead of having the government use this, if we could use it, instead of such the large, immense budget for social programs that is used so much for their propagation of the people involved in them, you have a terrible waste. Besides, we miss the opportunity of evangelism of this world. I think there is no place that could be any more bedrock than for our own congregations to serve the ministry of the poor. It would further the ministry of the churches. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me that we have no choice. Unless we are concerned with this, this washover will soon be on every person, and it'll be on your seminary here. Up in Nebraska, there was a suit. I don't know whether it was a good suit or not, regarding a school had been closed, a parochial school. A Catholic nun, of all things, came and gave testimony. And she said this. She said, you know, we tried to work with the state. And in the working with the state over these years, we have totally lost our autonomy and our individualism. We have become a state school simply because we have tried to follow your regulations. Perhaps I'm wrong, but I see a terrible encroachment of government upon the religious liberties of America. I think we should approach them sanely, intelligently, non-emotionally. The moral majority here, we are autonomous from a national organization. We believe in education and information. We publish what the legislators and all, how they voted on the issues. Let that person make up his mind or her mind. You know, it's awfully difficult when they pull that curtain and vote to tell a man how he has to vote. Say, you can't do it. He'll vote the way he wants to vote anyhow. These are things I'm sorry I did not get finished, and I appreciate being here.
As was the case with this morning's presenters, Professor Gilming has graciously consented to field whatever questions you might have of him from his provocative remarks. I would ask, though, that those of you who have questions, please speak into the microphones and speak audibly. I guess some people are having difficulty hearing. We will endeavor up here to repeat the questions so that everybody can hear and understand what's going on.
Yes, sir. As you began your talk this afternoon, and as you concluded it, you referred to a reaction to the encroachment of government upon the schools as being one of your prime concerns. That's something with which I can well resonate as the son of a Lutheran school teacher, and it's something with which our denomination can well resonate because we have had, in the history of our denomination, to react to the action of government encroaching upon our schools. My question for you, both as an individual and as a member of the moral majority, is there not a difference between reaction to government encroachment, especially when it goes against the proper biblical place for the church, and that kind of positive political action on the part of individual Christians or church groups, which has the potential to encroach on the freedoms of others? Is there not a very difficult line to draw there? And if there is, how does the moral majority attempt to draw that line so that they do not become like they have accused liberals and humanists of being?
Yes. There, of course, is a very narrow line there in that. And as long as you have people, you probably have different reactions in each situation. But any time that this is improperly against the Constitution, then it should not be pressed. If the Constitution protects, then it could, with an open heart as a Christian, one could follow that. But in no way should a dogmatism with personal interests be involved in these cases. Now you take, for instance, when there are certain safety regulations, smoke alarms, those things, a Christian school should put those in and be just as safe as any other public building. That should be no contest at all. And in every one of those areas, we ought to cooperate where we can, only where they infringe on our conscience before God. Did I answer your question?
The difficulty comes when our conscience before God disagrees with the individual conscience of another. You refer to the Constitution, yet there are many movements within certain political groups on the right,
yes,
to modify the Constitution. I suppose one could cite some of the disagreements between Christians upon economic approaches or the whole question of military things. These are not clearly laid down in Scripture, as some would like to make them lay down.
Well, I feel, without being presumptuous, it is rather simple in this respect. One goes through the channels of the law. The channels of the law do not agree with you. If you feel you have enough case, then through the channels of the law, change that law. Otherwise, you have to take what's come to you.
The legislation of morality has always been a problem, and there have been some notable defeats, like with the enforcement of prohibition in our country. The whole motivation of changing someone by making a thing legal or illegal is certainly an issue you're aware of. Our student has not said it's wrong to speak publicly on political issues. A professor here spoke of the church's vital voice in the marketplace, but there seems to be a voice of not just legalism, but a voice of morality from the pulpit that perhaps gets in the way of the idea that you've only changed through the use of the gospel. That's why when our church doesn't use the pulpit for a political avenue, a political podium. Why do you think that can be done more often or in a fundamentalist church? Or why should it be done?
First of all, I agree with you about using the pulpit as a political stem. I do not. I am the chairman of Mormon Majority. You can ask my 1,500 people, you will not find one of them that will tell you that they have a problem with this. I have a personal right as a citizen. Now, society has to be governed by morals. I mean, it's only to the degrees. Where do you stop them? Murder has morals in it. Where do you stop? And again, it has to be as the majority of the people. Basically with people, you still have a great mass of people who, though they may not be Christian in the personal sense, still do have great basic underlying Christian traditions. A society has to legislate moralism. Where is the degree of that?
Society legislates moralism in our political makeup. I
guess
like as opposed to a totalitarian association.
That's right.
But a clergyman's voice is most often associated with his denomination. How do you make that distinction when you speak for moral majority and not saying that our church is trying to change people?
Now, I speak as a citizen for moral majority. However, again, my simply being a pastor probably, and you being a pastor, probably carries more clout than a normal citizen, wouldn't it? But I speak as a citizen.
Pastor Gilming, you mentioned the separation of church and state, and I think there may be some confusion in terminology. Earlier, when you were talking about fundamentalism, you also used the term separation, but then you weren't talking about separation of church and state.
No.
Could you explain what fundamentalists mean by the biblical doctrine of separation?
I'm not so sure I can. Fundamentalism, as I said, is very heterogeneous. And this is a problem, to be sure. I don't know that I could answer that question as to where that would be. I'm sorry.
Two points I'd like to get your impression on concerning this little item I received in the mail. Several months ago, I heard Jerry Falwell on the radio. He suggested that the listener might write in for a copy of the Moral Majority Report newsletter. And I thought it would be a good idea for me to try to keep up on what's going on even in the political realm there. And before I got my first issue of the paper, I got this little card which says in the front, Moral Majority, in the picture of the dome and the circle and everything. This is to certify that Mr. Joel A. Brondes is a member of the Moral Majority Incorporated. Signed by Jerry Falwell, President. My initial reaction, I didn't know whether to send it back or what. And I guess just in case I should die and it would be on my possession or something, I wrote that something in nature that I didn't quite believe this is true. And I sort of, first of all, felt that for them to do this isn't moral, that, you know. Especially since I've heard some fundamentalists argue against the Lutheran view of justification, that the fact that God has chosen us, that he loves us.
Yes.
It's not moral if a Christian doesn't have a choice. And, you know, saying that we are immoral by making somebody a member of the kingdom of God without that person having a choice. So that seems contradictory there. Secondly, I would feel that I would agree with you if you feel that Christians can get together as citizens to defend and protect their rights as citizens for the church, the freedom that we now have and enjoy. But on the back of this card, it says, this certifies that the bearer of this card is an active member of the Moral Majority, and secondly, and is helping to bring this nation back to moral sanity. And that's what I guess basically have problems with, that if the Moral Majority is only going to preserve and protect the rights and freedoms that we have as a church, okay, I can see that. But if we are going to use political means to, shall we say, evangelize the world, to cut out homosexuality and prostitution and so forth, I think this is wrong. And I'm totally against homosexuality and pornography and all that stuff.
Yes, I understand.
To me, we're not, by trying to get at those problems politically, we're not really dealing at the heart and the root of the matter in the sense of showing these people that they are creatures of God and that this is not what their bodies have been made for and so forth.
Yeah.
So I just feel that it's wrong to try to use a political way to get the nation back to moral sanity.
Well, I agree with you. I think this is over-aggressiveness, sending you a card like this. And I think it hurts rather than helps. We are autonomous as a state. But on the other hand, let me ask you this. What is your plan to deal with these subjects? Most people don't have a plan, and a plan that does work is better than no plan. And most of the time, we have not had anything that's really hit home and affected something as we have had in this. And we, in the state of Missouri, we're divided up into congressional districts, 10 congressional districts. They're divided in four parts, each congressional district. Then each of those counties have a county chairman. Then the county chairman from there on is not broken down. And as those see these, what are But I feel those which nearly all, I think all of us would agree on, as you said, you're against these certain things, they can react in their own local situation to do something about it. This does not have anything to do with the preaching of the gospel. This is only keeping the vehicle for the preaching of the gospel open. If our vehicle breaks down, we're in trouble.
I just want to say I do appreciate some of the work that the Mormon majority is doing to bring some of these things to the foreground, to make even me aware of what I can do as a citizen. But I do somewhat, I'm disappointed in that sometimes the Mormon majority becomes a little bit too aggressive, as you say, and gives, I almost feel it gives the Christianity a bad name to the world in that sense. Can you understand that?
I do. Too
pushy.
I do. I'm afraid I have to agree with you on some of that. I hate to, but I'm afraid I do.
Not that we're going to be light in the world.
I understand.
We will be happy. Your yelling is happy to field the remaining questions. If you could, try to keep the question brief and pointed and not embellish it in a great deal of narrative.
Yes, my question has to deal with the funding of the Mormon majority. As earlier you listed groups which represented various denominations in Washington, D.C. I was curious to know what groups of special interest, and I don't mean individuals, I understand quite a large amount of your funding is from individuals, but what special interest groups are represented in the Mormon majority, funding-wise?
In the state of Missouri, we have none. We send out a MMM letter, and it's voluntary. If anyone wishes to contribute, they can. And we don't have any cards, I'm sorry, to send out. But it's all voluntary. At this point, it is a combination of churches and of individuals who support the Missouri Mormon majority.
Okay.
We have no membership.
Okay. The second part of my question is through information I received from Wesley Walters, who is a Presbyterian minister and a leading authority on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Mormons. He informed me that there was a group who was not so named the Mormons, but were large contributors to the Mormon majority. And I was curious if this was true, if you had any information on this.
I don't know about the national level on the contributions that they have. It is not generally, though, funded rather than just companies, sometimes companies or individuals or something. I do not know on the national level.
And I guess final part of my question would be, if this were so, and I respect the opinion and the inside knowledge of Mr. Walters, and this is a complaint that I do have concerning the Mormon majority, in their efforts to present a unified political front, do you feel that you and members of the Mormon majority have to sacrifice a unified theological front? And that would be my last question. I'll sit down for that.
I do not feel I would, otherwise I would not be in it. Baptists are very dogmatic, you know. I would answer that negative.
My question has to deal with the pastor's involvement in any political, organized political action at all. Paul's statement that he determined to know nothing but Christ and him crucified, and our being involved in political action, not just simply preaching from the pulpit on whether an issue is right or wrong, but getting involved in political action, how can we as pastors separate in our image to people outside the congregation present an image that, well, this is only concerning my citizenship. It has nothing to do with my being a representative of the church. How can people outside looking in make that distinction in our actions and not equate our soul message with our political action rather than our preaching of Christ?
Well, of course, to reverse that with the liberals, they have the same problem, only a great deal larger, don't they? How are you ever going to get apart from that? There's a job that has to be done. You have to make those distinctions. In most part, I would say in my own relationship with Moral Majority, I think people outside the church respect me in this office as long as I keep it separate. A lot of them don't agree, but I think they respect. And I think you can keep it separate. I think you need to.
I guess the real question is, what do they identify your message as?
Well,
do they identify it as one of law or one of gospel?
Well, I would hope gospel.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Preston Yelnick, you mentioned in your presentation that the prophets directed the kings of Israel and Judah, and not the reverse. I was just wondering that in applying that to the program of the Moral Majority, if you are equating the United States with Israel or Judah, because certainly that was not true of other nations in the ancient Old Testament world, that prophets directed kings, advised them. But I was just wondering how that related to the Moral Majority's program, that example, saying that the prophets directed the kings and not vice versa. And I guess there's a second part to my question. What, for our instruction, what particular scripture passages would you call upon in the teaching of the Old Testament prophets or in Jesus or Paul's teaching that led to a directive to involve oneself as a Christian in an organized way in political action?
All right. Well, to answer the last question first, Jesus Christ had given to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to Christ the things that are Christ's. There's a dual relationship here. Now, in that period of time, they did not have a republic form of government as we have. But he still had that. Paul resorted to his Roman citizenship on several occasions. And where it would benefit him, or the gospel's sake, he used that. And especially today, in our time, our vehicle is open and ready to use if Christians or Christian citizens will use it. And now you take, for instance, right here in your area, you young men could make a tremendous impact right around here in St. Louis because of the number of you, because where you are, simply by your involvement in this, and it wouldn't slack one bit with your studies nor your church. You'd simply be acting as a citizen, and no telling how much you could help this. Young girls that are getting raped, the just vicious sins that go on. We must do something, or we have anarchy one of these days.
Thank you.
Excuse me, I regret doing this. There is an ample opportunity for questions to be voiced in the panel format after we hear Dr. Johnson's presentation. I would invite you three gentlemen and anyone else who has additional questions they'd like to pose to either Drs. Klaus or Scare or Professor Gelming or Dr. Johnson to perhaps indulge us and give us those questions during the panel discussion. Thank you. At this point, we have a short 10-minute break. We resume again, I guess, at 2:15, if my schedule is correct. So if you want to stretch or get up and walk around a little bit, please be back at 2:15. Sure.